as we talked about the brokenness or the sin of racism, we talked about how the isms which oppress others, in this case racism, is really a case of us trying to reorder creation. Sue said it in a sense of trying to, or not trying to, but actually breaking all Ten Commandments at once by questioning or challenging the sovereignty of God, by saying, God, you didn't quite create the world right, and white people are superior to other peoples, and we deserve some benefits, and we deserve some things that other people don't. And it's really the sin of racism is questioning the sovereignty of God, that we want to reorder what God ordered quite nicely at the time of creation. And so that was our faith statement, our weaving for the week as we journeyed together. The second piece that I wanted to share with you in an overview sense is something that normally if we often do workshops that go on for 2 or 3 or 4 days and have lots of time to spend together in dialogue. And generally when we do that, we try and take a good chunk of time to create some definitions, some common understanding, so that the language we use, we don't constantly trip over one another in terms of our meanings or definitions. Well, we don't have that time here together as a community and this focus in such a single fashion. And so we want to share with you definitions for two basic words that when we use them, we ask you to understand that that's what we mean. We invite you to join us after the sessions and in the coming week in dialogue about these if you've got some questions or some uneasiness about them. But at least understand that when we talk about prejudice, we mean that that's any attitude or opinion. They are often irrational and especially of a hostile nature, which are based on prejudgment and insufficient information about a group of people. And it's our understanding that because of brokenness in the world, or sin, if you will, all people are prejudiced. That we are all capable of disliking the other. And very often that's based on stories we've been told about other people, kind of myths, if you will, half-truths, generalizations, usually based on insufficient information. And they can indeed be of a hostile nature, where it's a strong dislike, a hatred, if you will, of the other that's different from us. That's important, though, because we like to distinguish between prejudice and racism, because our understanding of racism is that racism is any attitude or action or institutional practice which subordinates people because of their color. And with that definition, we like to say that it requires institutional power to enforce your prejudice against other peoples in order to be racist. And because of that definition, it's our understanding that in the United States today, white persons are racist because we have institutional power in our institutions, whether it be the criminal justice system, in the banking and industrial system, whether it be in the schools, wherever it might be, that institutions in our country, in our society, are based on white assumptions, are based on white cultural models and norms, and that we have the institutional power to enforce our prejudices against other persons. Whereas people of color in our country, by and large, particularly on an institutional level, don't have that power. So that even though some black people may be prejudiced against whites, or Native Americans against blacks, or Hispanics against Asians, or whatever, the institutional power to enforce those prejudices in so many areas of life just doesn't exist. Is that Is that kind of clear? If we want to talk in depth about it, we ask that we do that outside the sessions just because of our time limitations.
But we'll actually get around to doing some of that tonight.
Yeah. But at least when Sue and I talk, we make those distinctions between prejudice and racism. And it's been our experience that oftentimes we generally, in our general conversation, intermix those, most of us. We see those as kind of the same, and we like to draw that distinction, if you will. The final thing that, or at least one of the things that we want to share this evening, the final thing we want to share this evening is the interconnectedness, if you will, of oppression in our world and in our culture. And by that I mean we often experience with folks who are kind of myopic about their issue. And so, for example, sometimes when it comes to nationalism, militarism, peace issues in the world, people will say, well, if we would just solve the issue of the possibility of nuclear war in the world, then the world would be a better place. Then, you know...
It would be better.
Right, but that oppression would fall away and that it would be... that everything would be okay. And it's our understanding, our analysis, that oppression in any form of others, whether it be because of our nationalism or our militarism, whether it be because of our sex, whether it be because of race, or because of class and economic issues, whether it be because of issues of age, or because of one's sexual preference. When people are oppressed because of these issues, and the day we did this, we listed about, I think we would have needed a geometric form that was 12-sided at least in order to get them all on. We happen to be working with this cube. That these are interrelated forms of oppression. And starting a little bit this evening, but in the coming week, we hope to be able to share some tools in our tools of analysis in our sessions, which will help you. We'll be focusing primarily on racism, but they're tools of analysis which can be applied to some of the other isms, to some of the other forms of oppression, which when you experience or see oppression going on, you could say, now let's see, do I have a model that helps me interpret this a little bit so that I might understand how to address or get at this particular form of oppression? And the last thing about this model that I want to share, at least in review, is that oppression, when it's viewed in this sense, that if you're a black, poor woman, you may suffer from triple oppression. And so to just address one area of a person's life, and sometimes that's kind of that happens in liberal settings often, where we'll make some attempt to provide a cure or a remedy for oppression, and we'll clean up one area of oppression, and then we'll say, well, what's wrong with those people? You know, we've got minimum standards of living and minimum income for people. So I don't understand why they haven't pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and begun to improve their lot in life. Well, it may well be that they still live and suffer from a variety of other forms of oppression, which haven't been addressed necessarily by a particular remedy. And it's very complex in that sense. So I guess those are the three things we wanted to share kind of in an overview fashion before we went on this evening. Are there any basic questions about any of that?
We saw a chart on Arter City indicating that in 25 to 30 years, the blacks and all those people that are oppressed now will be up to about 50% of our population in that many years, because the birth rate of the blacks and the minorities so far surpass the white birth rate that they will Yep, pretty close to 50%. So the tables will turn gradually, whether anyone likes it or not, or if the bikes got busy with their birth rate deal.
Don't look at me.
No, that is, the tables will turn.
One of the statistics that we have just recently, some of the new kind of futuring things that are out, by the year 2020, the year 2020, the population of the United States will be, white persons will be less than half of the population of the United States. This is the whole United States. That's one of the things we're talking about, because we really are talking about, if we are a multicultural, diverse society, how do we be that? And the other part of that is that it still can be, it can still have institutional power and prejudice. And all we have to do is look at Namibia, South Africa, where the minority persons still have all of the institutional power. The white population has all the institutional power. So it's still a racist society. And you could say by sheer numbers that black persons should be the people of power, but they're not. Okay, so that's a really good point. And really, one of the things we really have to talk about, and one of the reasons why we're talking about racism with white folks, because we need to recognize who we are, where we are. We're real careful about using minority. If you're white, you are not in a world, understanding the world, you are not a minority, you're not a majority person. You are a minority person in the world. And
especially those of us with blue eyes.
Thank you. White.
You brown-eyed folk, you're a little...
I don't know. You want to take that down? Sure. I have three things that I just wrote this afternoon, brought together this afternoon, and then this dialogue I promised you is going to happen. I just wrote these down from our discussion this week. One of the things that is clear to us, that we focus a lot on racism, and that's what we're talking about, and we don't make a lot of apologies for that, because we really believe that if you understand how one form of oppression works, you'll be able to look at and understand other forms of oppression. So we may use examples from the oppressions of your life, in your lives, that you feel, so that you can understand and relate to how racism works, and then in turn use how, once you understand how racism works, to understand how other systems work. Does that make sense? I kind of said that around and backwards, but we are looking at racism with, but our understanding is that that's not the only ism, and that's not the worst problem or the best problem or whatever. It's just one serious form of oppression, and we're talking about it because if you look around you at Holden, we're dealing with an all-white community, and that's a good time to talk about it. And that's my third point, and I'm going to jump because that's since I led to it. It's our concern, because if we're talking about racism and using our definitions, we are the ones here that need to be talking about racism. Often we say, well, there's no black people here, so we don't have to talk about it, or we can't talk about it.
Romans 7.
It's their problem. And it's not their problem. Racism is our problem. It is what the white institutional structures do and how they operate. So that's what we're talking about. The other piece for us, and this is helpful always to keep in mind, that it's much easier to change ourselves than it is to change the institutions we participate in. It's so simple, right? I shouldn't even have to say that, but I have to remind myself that all the time, that just because I've changed my language to reflect a different understanding of the world, that I try not to say minority, because that if I say minority, I forget that I am, in fact, a minority. If I try to change my language, that doesn't change the institutions I belong to. It doesn't change the fact that our language in and of itself is oppressive, and we'll talk some more about that this week, because we have a whole thing on language. But those are some of the things we're talking about. It seemed to me, as we were doing all of this, that one of the hardest things about doing racism work, anti-racism work, is that I'm really sitting in a room with experts. You are all experts. You all know how racism works. You've been trained as well as I have on the ins and outs of how racism works in your life. It just needs some time. Sometimes we just need some clues on how that works. So I have a series of questions for you. And I'll ask you for some dialogue. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a statement of some of which I've heard this week and others which I've heard in other workshops we've done and in other times, and some are conglomerates of things I've heard. And I would like to ask you, what are the assumptions, what are the distortions behind the statement? You know, what you hear, and then what are the distortions that make it seem okay to say that, even though they're racist, they favor the white system, they enforce institutional power. So let me try one and see if you get it. First one, we don't have a racist problem here. We don't have any black people. Now, what's the distortion in that statement?
Out of sight, out of mind.
Okay, it's out of sight, out of mind. What else might be there?
You might have people who aren't black.
Okay.
Who are Asian or Hispanic or...
One of my favorite things at Lutheran, when I was the director of Lutheran Human Relations, we would get a note saying, we don't have that problem in our community. We'd like to support you. We don't have that problem in our community. And I would look for that community on the map. And one time, the congregation was actually located geographically on an Indian reservation. We don't have that problem here. Oftentimes, it was very close.
Yeah, well, sometimes we all look at TV, or we read, or go to the movies. We see others different than our color.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. We make judgments.
Whether
sure. We have them in our community or not.
And we're not isolated. Yeah. We are not that isolated anymore, that people have had some experience. The other, what else?
I just going to say, that comment makes it sound as if it is the blacks who are the cause of racism, and
Absolutely.
Actually it's the institutions as you're trying to make that
sure.
point.
We don't have that problem because they aren't here. Is this saying they're the problem?
Their presence isn't necessary because we all have our own attitudes. We all belong to different organizations, different institutions. We've all had our same background. Their presence isn't necessary for us to be racist.
That's right. That's exactly what the distortion is. So what we do when we say we don't have that problem, they're not here, we're saying that problem is their problem. And in the words of a lot of the stuff from the early 70s and 60s, that's called blaming the victim. Mm-hmm. Saying, well, they're not here, that's their problem. You're really good. I don't know if that's a compliment or not. You figure out. Ingrid.
It's also true that it's possible that they're not here because we are so white in our style, our attitudes, what we do, so that people of color don't feel invited, don't feel comfortable, don't feel welcome, haven't even heard about it because it doesn't travel in their circles, all of which means that we're choosing to advertise in white circles and to, you know, we're
very intentional. Sometimes it's unintentional, like we just don't create an atmosphere that people feel welcome, and sometimes they're very intentional. We lived in Dubuque, Iowa, before open housing things were happening, and the companies there, which were two major companies called John Deere and the Pack, Dubuque Packing, were major employers who were into affirmative action, and they were trying to hire people of color, and they couldn't because
No housing.
And they had to do some very behind the scenes fair housing kinds of actions to prove that in that city there was no place for a person of color to live. Well, you can have all the we're welcome, we're open. And then those institutions, those employers, didn't feel it was their responsibility to deal with housing. So we don't have that problem because they won't come to work and their hours are irregular. Well, they're traveling 30, 40 miles to work, time changes, all kinds of stuff. So we reinforce the system. All right, let's try another one.
Do you involve ethnocentricity at all in your racism definition?
Say more.
Well, take Milwaukee, for example. You've got all these little communities. And they don't consciously say, well, we can't live over here with the rest of the Italians. We've got to integrate. They kind of live together. Don't they? You know,
yes.
They tend to have neighborhoods.
Yes, and Milwaukee is an absolutely wonderful example of that, since it's recent studies have proven that it is the most segregated city, a major city in the United States. We even are better than Chicago.
My question is, what's the relationship between ethnocentricity and racism? Is it different?
Well, I think one of the things that happens when you're a highly ethnocentric community, that you promote and you're so highly aware of your traditions and culture, and that it makes an even tighter set of cultural assumptions about what it means to be normal or right or to be like us, so that it becomes very hard for any other group to break into that, you know, whether it be German or Italian or Polish or whatever. That I think it heightens the potential and the difficulty of change and helping people. So I mean, in some ways our church is like that. You know, we're you know, we haven't gotten over the difference between Norwegians and Germans in our Lutheran stream yet. And
we don't even know about Finns and Danes.
No, I was going to say Swedes. I mean, well, since you brought up Milwaukee specifically,
we have some people here from Milwaukee.
Do you think that these summer national festivals that they have are doing anything either to break down or to promote the attitude?
Let's look at that a little bit. It seems
most of them may not know what that is.
Milwaukee, they've got summer festivals, and they have Mexican fest and Italian fest and German fest and Polish fest, and people from around the country come to celebrate their nationalities. Mm-hmm. Now, I hear in your questions us saying that, well, that feels pretty good. You know, those are kind of neat things, and why would we not want to have those? And I would kind of affirm that. Because part of what we're talking about, being a multicultural, diverse community, is to say that it is really wonderful to be Italian. There are wonderful things about being Italian. You learn to talk with your hands at a very early age. You learn to be, Italian men could probably teach some of our white European-style men something about the grace of being able to touch each other and hold each other and cry on each other's shoulders. I mean, so we have, what we're talking about this whole week is learning from one another and celebrating differences. What happens in that is there's no white fest. Well, there really is. That's called summer fest. But what we assume is there's the Hispanic culture, and there's the Italian culture, and there's the Norwegian culture, and there's all these other cultures. But there's some of us that aren't burdened by culture. So what we don't see, and some of what we're trying to dig at here, is what we don't see when we talk about that, is that we have culture as white people. Mm-hmm. In this country, white people today have culture. And some of it is geographic. But some of it there is a white culture. And we don't see it. It's hard to see. It's as hard to see your own white culture as it is to hear your own accent. I never knew I had an accent. I mean, I really, and I still have a real hard time hearing my accent. I have to listen to a tape. I have to have somebody else reflect that to me. Okay, so So what we're really talking about this week is how do we become aware of what our culture is so that we can learn to dialogue with people of other cultures and celebrate that diversity and share in it and learn from each other. I came from Norwegian grandmother and an Italian grandfather on my mom's side. Well, they learned a whole lot about integrating culture. And I kind of reflect that schizophrenia of that union. But that's some of what we're talking about. How do you bring those things together? You're doing well, but let's go on. Go.
We are celebrating white culture because all of us are descended from Norwegians, Danes, and Italians, and all of these festivals are those nationalities. So we are celebrating white culture.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
Because none of us is, you know, unless you're a Native American, I mean,
And we even have a Native American festival.
One of the prime differences, though, and that's where racism really takes place, is that we can put that on and off kind of like a shirt. When a festival comes along or whatever, we can claim our Irish or our German or our Italian heritage. And the next day, we can go to work, and if there's some prejudice against those heritages at our place of employment or with a friend or whatever, we don't have to bring that up and we can do just fine. If you're a black person in America, you can't do that. If you're a native person who is obviously native or an Asian person in our culture or a person of a primary language other than English like Spanish in our culture, you can't do that. You got to live with it every day. I can't decide, well, I'll be German and go to German Fest this week, but I'll disclaim any Germanic background in terms of my stubbornness or my temperament or whatever. A black person, an Asian American, can't do that.
They can drop some of their cultural habits, you know, the cultural stuff, but they can't change the fact that they're black and cannot. They have to live with that in the white culture because of the white culture. That leads to this question, and I think we're going to come around to all these things again. Now, your task here, remember, is to find the assumptions behind. My parents had to struggle when they came to this country from, fill in the blank there, and they made it. I don't know why black persons can't do the same. What's that?
Boy, you've heard that one a lot.
Yeah, you hear that all the time. I didn't make these up out of it. I mean, they're out of my own head. I mean, I've heard. These are things I hear. What's the distortion there? What's the distortion? My parents made it.
It's the whole work ethic. That if you work hard enough, you can get it, and you can keep going, and you can get it. And it doesn't include all the boundaries that may get in the way.
Right.
Whether it's pre-cultural heritage, you know. An example would be, you know, the Mexican American who culturally is a little more laid back and is interpreted as being lazy. Or, you know, the black community a lot of times, and you know, coming from a very strong, I'm getting off tangent a little bit.
That's all right, we all do that.
Coming from a family with a very, very strong work ethic because of being first generation Americans. I often thought that. It's like, why can't the black students? I don't understand this. I mean, the Vietnamese, they come over and they turn all these ghettos into wonderful, productive places. You know, and one of my close girlfriends is half black, half white, and grew up in a very white family, and then married a gentleman who's black. And I never could understand that. And with her exposure with that and trying to figure out, I don't think, I mean, there's a lot of things that are in the way, but one of the things that she exposed to me was the fact that they don't necessarily get the encouragement and the support and the hope to see that vision that they can get ahead because they didn't feel that there was any hope.
Okay, first of all, that ignores that one of the things you're talking about, that assumption, that statement, ignores the roots. You know, it ignores the historical reality of why your parents came and why black folks came. I mean, it's real serious. It ignores what happened when they all got here. You know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and in the working for someone where you are a slave is called whatever. Leaving the, you just don't walk up and get better yourself from slavery without some serious ramifications. So it does ignore that. Yeah,
the blacks are preaching.
So what's happening? What if we're all teaching our kids basically the same thing? why is it statistically that black kids aren't doing as well?
Well, they are improving.
But because this statement ignores the systemic constant breakdown of the possibilities for blacks. All of this stuff we're going to talk about is part of the system. And so if a person wants to excel, even if you're given all the rhetoric to do that, you still have to work through the system, and the system's rigged in favor of white people.
Of course, Mary Young is black, and I see Detroit rigged in favor of the blacks. So I see an entirely different view.
Let's hold that one and think on it, because we're going to hear that more and more. And let's think on what that might mean.
Well, isn't? I'm sorry.
All right, go ahead, and then we'll.
I was going to say, well, isn't your point then that because there are blacks who make it, quote unquote, make it in white society, that somehow means that it's not quite as bad as saying all our institutions are racist. Yeah. I think it's true that there are some blacks that make it in white society, but the vast majority is that the blacks that make it are in certain arenas in which they're allowed to make it. Sports is one of them. And I think it's only when we can forget about whether somebody's making it in a sports arena or someplace else that we can really begin to think we might be breaking down those systems. But I think success by individuals in an oppressed group is, in a sense, controlled or allowed by the group in power. We, in a sense, I don't want to be too heavy on this, but I think we allow blacks to succeed in certain arenas.
Throwing out a few tidbits, like saying, here, see, it's not so bad. You made it. It's not so bad.
Then using that, and then using that to blame those who don't make it.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, and we can all say, my father, my mother came. My father came from Germany. He had a choice. Did blacks originally have a choice? And they still don't have that choice, except, as Tom says, occasionally certain ones rise up. And again, I don't know that it's, you know, real conscious, Tom, that happened.
Yeah, and I don't want to make it sound as if
no.
The fact of some blacks make it is a trick or is an insidious thing that whites are doing, because I think you're right. Some blacks do make it
and do succeed,
but how is that?
That slavery issue must just, you know, it's in their genes.
There's a whole lot of stuff dismantling the culture, and we can talk some more about that. We're also talking about our perceptions as white people here and our distortions. One of the things is, this goes back to some of what you were saying and some of what I've observed, in our city and in other cities, we talk about integrated schools. And somehow, if a school is 55% white and 45%, is that add up to 100%? 45% people thought we have an integrated school. Somehow when we have 55% black or people of color and 45% white, we have, they have a whole bunch of names for it. It becomes a problem school, a segregated school. There's all kinds of words that somehow in our sense of things, in our needing to be the 51%, the white, and that's a reflection of our need to be power, have power. Maintain power.
Demographically, in many communities that call themselves integrated or those kinds of communities, it may be 60, 65, 70% white and 30% persons of color. And as that shifts more towards 50-50 and then goes over that, then people start talking about, well, this neighborhood's getting awfully black.
know, that's why people will, we live right next door to a neighborhood in Milwaukee that's like that now. And now family after family that we know is moving out.
The white signs family, are going up. Boom, white, boom, boom, white right down the line.
Moving out because all of a sudden it's up to 40, 42, 43%. And people are getting nervous. When it was just a little bit more the other way, then everything was fine and they were good.
I don't mind living next to black
people, but,
and that's the go ahead.
Well, I don't blame the young blacks for being discouraged because their father didn't make it and their grandfather didn't make it. They have a whole history of not being able to make it because they weren't given a chance.
All right, so that distortion of that thing about my parents made it is ignoring all of what's happened in history.
Yeah, I mean, the young kids feel that they can't make it, so they don't try, and so they don't really work at it. And they feel that they can't make it no matter what they do.
Yeah.
If you take away a person's dignity, what we have been doing with the blacks for centuries, and even after they were free, they were still treated as slaves, it's going to take generations to get out of that. And I think we need to give them more encouragement and more education. We have to get out of our way and help.
And I think we need to, what we're doing here, is recognizing how we contribute to the continuing keeping of people in oppression, that we continue.
There's another area here that we haven't addressed, and that is, well, the single family, the single parent families, where I think statistics, and I hate statistics, especially the way we were using them before, when you have job quotas and all that kind of stuff, and those are poor excuses for not helping our black brothers and sisters. But you can show again and again and again the single family homes where it's the mother trying to raise the children, and the family structure isn't there for these kids to bring themselves up by their bootstraps like the European background or the other immigrants that have come in where there is a strong family structure. I think that's another element that needs to be dealt with. And I think our society has a responsibility to look at that and not point the finger and say, hey, you can make it just like anybody else. They can't because they don't have the support of the family. Many of them.
I think that goes in line with some of what you were saying about that. I also want to be really careful about some assumption here, checking out assumptions. I think you're right that there's an assumption in our society, the power, that institutional power thing, that we have defined family in a certain way. And there's a lot of oppression for a lot of people of color that may have a different family structures, but we've kind of, single parents, all kinds of folks, singles, widowed people, all don't fit into those definitions of family that are, and so there's a lot of oppression that's tied to that.
But it's a very prevalent thing in total black societies. This is
they had a big television.
Yeah. What I'm just doing is I'm taking it and looking at it. I'm turning it around to say, if we can't speak on behalf of people of color and the situation in those communities, because none of us here represent that, and I would certainly not want some of the group sitting around talking about what's wrong with women pastors without me there or some women pastors there to talk about it. But I do recognize in what you're saying is one of the assumptions is that a good family has to be in a certain
configuration.
A real family has a mom, a dad, and 2.2 kids, a dog, a cat.
I wasn't thinking of it in that context so much as I was thinking about children coming along and having only the mother at home who has to scrape and work and so on. And there was a film that came out of Los Angeles recently with all the gang wars, showing the mass killing of black males.
Obvious.
And they're not going out to work. They're going out to kill each other, which is very unfortunate. And the work ethic isn't part of their culture in that particular situation, which is a real tragedy.
Yeah. That's going to be the discussion this week, is to recognize that those are the things we're seeing. And the question is, what is our relationship to that? And do we participate? Do we, as white folks, participate in making that system happen? Do we participate in, have we been a part of the process that makes those kinds of statements possible? And you know what my answer is going to be, and I hope that we can have some dialogue about that.
Can I be a little bit of a devil's advocate here?
Well, certainly.
One of the things that bothers me about when we start discussing people of color or minorities or whatever term you want to use is the poor people of white extraction who are in equally bad circumstances. Now he spoke of the single mother. I know many single mothers who are white, who have no family support, who are raising lots of children, who are in fact not as able to get help as some of the black people are, because there is, in some cases, the feeling that if you don't help the black person, then you're showing prejudice. Well, you've probably heard that one too.
Think about the distortions in that.
Yeah. Okay. You can go back. Now, I remember when Kennedy was running for president. I don't know how many people I heard say that they were going to vote for him, even though they were not Democrats and they didn't particularly like him, because they didn't want to be prejudiced. Now, in this case, it was Catholicism.
Oh, that's right. Like, they didn't vote for him.
Yeah. Uh huh. They didn't want to vote for him. I think this is true in many areas.
I want to go back, because I think you're absolutely right, and I want to go back to the cube there that we talked about. Uh-huh. And Chuck just moved it. Did you move it to classism? Uh-huh. And there is. Mm-hmm. The problem we have is that we only have a week here, and we've kind of come with the side of the cube that facing this week is racism. But I'm trying very hard to be very clear that what you're talking about is oppression, and it is oppression. Mm-hmm. And in case we weren't clear, oppression is sin. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is sin when one person or group of persons decides that in fact God made them superior to another group of persons or person. And what you're talking about is as much of an oppression. But what we usually say is, that's another workshop.
Okay. Now, I personally, I've always felt that the big mistake they made when they had school busing was that they should have had integrated housing instead of school busing.
Well, if we get that by, if you hold that thought this whole week, we're going to have a good week.
So it seems to me that one never strives for anything that you know or have reason to know is not attainable. There's nothing that's going to motivate a young black person or an Asian person to go after a particular station in life if they know in advance that that's not open to them. In a way, you've been saying that. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me to treat this problem doesn't really... You can't deal with the peripheral, the surface matters out here. You've got to get at whatever it is that's closing the avenues. Let me give you an illustration. I'll make this as short as I possibly can. 1970, give or take a year, I forgot exactly which. The federal court in Seattle found that labor unions had refused to admit black persons to training, and therefore there were, you know, 1 in 1,000 black people as electricians and plumbers and so forth. And the court ordered that be remedied and set off targets, which came up to about 900 persons who were to be trained and admitted and be practicing journeymen in those trades, and held the unions and the employers hostage, and appointed a committee and
you'll pardon the personal reference, I was chairing of that committee, and we were ordered to do it. And we were given the kind of power that made it possible. I won't bother with the constitutional questions right now, but we can go to an employer and say, you hire a black person in this trade. Well, of course, there were no black electricians. So it became necessary to try and train them. This is the point I want to make. What should have taken us maybe 6 months to do, maybe 2 years, took us 14 years to do, for the very simple reason that we could not find black persons of the age of 18, 19, or 20 who had the necessary background, mathematics, English, schooling, to be able to become trained electricians. I mean, electricity is going to behave the same way no matter what color the person is who's putting in the plug. You've got to have that training or else you simply cannot do it. We had to go back to high school kids. And we had to persuade them, first of all, that if they would study math, there would be a job when they got there 5 years later. That's what it took. And somehow or other, it isn't a matter so much, I don't think, of integrating the schools or a lot of other things, but rather that may be all contributing to the fact that there is a recognized by the person against whom oppression has been exercised, that they are able to see that there will be an openness and therefore have a goal which is attainable. And I like your point about the institution, because our institution, i.e. the Caucasian population, largely has said to these people for generations, they don't care if you're a young genius, you are not going to be an electrician.
You're not capable. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It isn't a matter of being capable. I don't care how capable you are not going to be an electrician. That's my job.
I'm going to read you a story because it's time to read you a story. And then we'll go back to distortions if you want.
Well, it would almost be time.
Well, then we'll just have to keep this dialogue going all week. This story, this story is not, I'm not ignoring your comment.
Well,
I am following up with a little story. This is called Down the River is Not What's Up. This story happens in a little town that is located next to a river. It is a quiet and uneventful in this town until one night when one of the villagers is taking a walk along the river's bank. Looking out over the water, he sees a baby floating down the river, drowning. Of course, the villager is a caring person, so he rips off his shirt, he takes off his clothes, he jumps into the water, and he rescues the baby from certain death. The next day, two babies are seen floating down the river. And again, one of the villagers is at hand, jumps in, and rescues the two babies. The day after that, four babies are found, drowning in the swift flowing river. And the day after that, 8, and then 16, and then 32, and then 64. And day by day, more babies are floating down the river, facing certain death. The villagers, caring and efficient as they are, respond in a very good way. They set up a huge rescue operation. Divers are flown in from the next town to provide the services to jump into the water to rescue the babies who are drowning in the waters. Social workers come to town to provide much-needed adoption services and counseling to those families who are going to raise these babies. The local church group starts a sewing project to make blankets and other clothing that the babies need. The local service club engages in collecting food items for the babies. The pastors bless the operation and talk about it in the Sunday sermons. So life goes on in this village, and the rescue operation becomes a very important part of the life of many of the villagers. One night, during a meeting at the township council, a villager stands up and says, I would like to make a proposal. I would like to propose that we put together a team of people that will go upstream to find out where these babies are coming from. Well, the mayor responded, that might not be such a bad idea. But you know, we cannot spare anybody to do this. Everybody involved in this rescue operation is very much needed. But don't you see, said the villager, if we went upstream, if we found out who was doing this, we could stop the problem right at its source, right at its roots. We could make sure that no more babies were thrown into the river, and then we wouldn't have to rescue them from the water. No, we can't spare a single person, because if you pull anyone away from the rescue operation, babies are going to drown. We need everybody here to help us rescue these babies from the water. And so the proposal was defeated. The villagers never went upstream, never found out where these babies were coming from, but continued their very good work of rescuing the drowning babies. And because they were efficient and well organized, they rescued many, many babies. But many more were drowned. What time is it? Well, all I can say is there's more to come.
I bet those villagers all made their living off those babies.
You bet they did. And I bet it was easier to deal with babies than to go upstream and deal with someone else that might have to confront someone just like themselves, like their brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and grandparents and folks that live up the river.
Was there another country upstream?
Do we have...
I'd like to just coattail on that with a very personal frustration that I have along that exact same line. My best friend and roommate here is a nursery school teacher. And for the last 8 years, 9 years or so, I've been getting the kids that she had when they were 4 years old at the high school level as a high school counselor. And we've shared stories. You know what I'm going to say. Problem kids that we've had at the high school, I'll share stories with Nancy, and she'll say, oh yeah, when that kid was 4 years old, I saw the problem starting. And I have been preaching in our school district for years and years and years, why don't we get down to the kindergartens and the first grade and the second grade and provide more guidance and more assistance for those kids and stop addressing the dropout problem only at the high school.
And that's
exactly what you just said.
And I'm also saying that we're going before preschool and find out
before,
what some of the stuff that happens that makes those